You've heard the Pan Am commercials. Millions hear them every day. Now listen to interpretations of the music from these commercials that are making people get up and go.
Leave the phone off the hook. Teach the cat how to cook.
Be a man, not a mouse. Sell your car, rent your house.
Get away, right away, like today. For once in a lifetime, get into this world.
Let the golf take its course. Let the car get a horse.
Leave the house up a tree, lock the door, lose the key.
Get away, right away, like today. For once in a lifetime, get into this world.
Pan Am makes the going great. Pan Am makes the going great. Pan Am.
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if I had to pick a Game of Thrones character to compete in an Olympic event, I would pick Sam, who would brush for my curling team because he's so good with that scrubbing.
Oh, poops and scrubs call out. All right. My name is Joanna Robinson, and if I were to pick a Game of Thrones character to compete, I believe it was specifically a winter Olympic sport, I would pick the most decayed white to run the skeleton. I don't think you run. I don't think you run a skeleton. Do you slide a skeleton?
Yeah, skeleton is luge, but the other way around.
Yeah, do the skeleton. A skeleton for the skeleton. All right.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to get a Game of Thrones character to do a Winter Olympic sport, I'd be bringing back my girl Ygritte for biathlon, because when it comes to running / skiing and then shooting arrows at targets, she would be the best, although in biathlon, I think you have a gun. But in the Westeros version, you would have an arrow.
All right. Come on.
I just remembered right now that biathlon is a gun thing, and it's the Summer Olympic one where you shoot an arrow.
That's why I asked you before we started if there was archery in the Winter Olympics.
Yeah, and
so
I was sure that I was right until just now.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I'm sure she'd do just as well with a gun. We really don't have any evidence based on that. But,
yeah,
you know, surely it's somewhat, at least the endurance. She's got the endurance for it.
She's the number one marksman from her hovel.
Oh, I really like the idea of Sam on the curling team. And I would like to hear more ideas from our listeners of like which Game of Thrones character you think would be good at Winter Olympics. Cause there's a lot of Summer Olympics I can think of. Like, there's fencing and there's like, you know, all this other stuff. But for winter, which is mostly
winter is coming,
mostly sliding around on snow in some form or another. Basically, which wildling would you pick for your team?
Oh, man, Dave. Sam and Bran, because as someone who's watched a lot of curling in the last couple days can tell you, there's a lot of strategy and a lot of like trying to figure out what your opponent's going to do. Bran could just touch a tree and be like, I know what my opponents are going to do.
Wouldn't the trees have to know what the opponents are going to do then?
If Bran could see the future, then
is
yes.
There's like a scooting position.
Can Bran see
curling,
the future,
right?
Or not? We
still, let's move on. Let's move on.
All right. This is, of course, A Storm of Spoilers, the pop culture podcast that sometimes talks about Game of Thrones and will be this week. But we also got some mailbag questions from you, the listeners, about various pop culture topics that we're going to answer. There will be, as I was saying, some Game of Thrones talk. It will involve spoilers for the upcoming season, as is our want and title. We will, however, let you know when those are coming, so you could jump off if that's not your cup of tea. But first, our usual show-starting segments. Joanna has reviews.
Got a couple. This one comes from someone named Dark Gently. Not Dark Gently, but Dark Gently. The best of casts, the worst of casts. 5 stars. But then there's like no worst of So don't be bracing yourself for anything.
No, I was bracing myself.
This podcast is an utter sublime joy. Smart and jovial, generous and exacting. And with the help of Toto, the Dorothy who's willing to see the man behind the curtain. Oh, yeah. This review comes with like a little prompt that I think we should decide at the end of it. If you understand, then you know the best and the worst. Balance a perfect, unassuming it is. I don't know if that's supposed to be Yoda. A triumvirate of grace and spirit this universe has not seen since Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. That's the end of the review. So my question to you, Neil and Dave, is which one of us is Kirk? Which one of us is Spock? Which one of us is McCoy?
Don't do this.
I'm for sure McCoy.
Really?
Aren't all three of them supposed to be inside of us? Isn't that the point? I'll let Neil have McCoy.
100% just because bones.
That would leave me if it's between me for Kirk and Spock, I feel like I'd have to step into Kirk even though I want Spock, because I feel like Joanna, you're the Spock.
That's so funny. I think you're the Spock. Not because like you're kind of more the leader of this podcast, so I would make you Kirk, but when it comes to like demeanor and behavior, you're the even-keeled logical one and I'm the like emotional one left over from a bygone era, which I think is Kirk. So I don't know.
Oh, interesting. I like that. It's just we don't know what a pro-feminist Kirk really looks like, so it just doesn't come to my mind easily. But when you explain it like that, I am happy to be Spock.
All right,
which was my preference.
Here we go.
Wouldn't Kirk, like a Spock, super feminist Kirk just be Kirk but a woman?
No, because just because bone ladies doesn't mean you're like pro lady. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Because the way Kirk treated the ladies is not like if I met a lesbian I'd be like,
it would be a woman version of Kirk who treats men like that.
No, that's like misandry versus feminism. Right?
Okay. I think a captain that respects gender as much as Kirk respects sexuality would be a pro-feminist Kirk.
Whoa.
Great. I'm glad we had this chat. This is my second.
We got real deep real quick.
This is my second review. And please let us know if you disagree which one is Kirk, which one is Spock, which one is McCoy. This is from Direwolf09. 5 stars. My favorite podcast. It gets a little bit in the weeds about Frasier, but like I'm going to go there because, it's Frasier.
Take this chance.
Hi, guys. Another great job. I enjoy the conjecture about reboots and, of course, Game of Thrones. So this is like in response to an older episode. But as someone who works on Broadway shows and has worked for around David Hyde Pierce and Kelsey Grammer, it's odd that Joanna thinks that Grammer might not do more Frasier because he's a crazy Republican and Hyde Pierce is now openly gay. For one thing, I'm not sure, but Grammer might have had some clue that Hyde Pierce is gay, maybe. Also, Grammer was in La Caja Fall and seems pretty comfortable with the different sexual choices and identities. I know that Joanna has strong feelings about Frasier because the sound she made was unlike anything I've ever heard on a podcast. It reminded me of a Princess Bride. The Princess Bride, the sound of ultimate suffering. Maybe Joanna's was a sound of ultimate hopefulness. Anyway, thanks. I don't remember. I mean, I remember talking about Kelsey Grammer being super conservative. I don't remember like implying that because David Hyde Pierce is gay, Kelsey Grammer wouldn't want to work with him. If I did imply that, that was not my intention. So I agree with you. I don't think Kelsey Grammer being in show business as he has been for as long as he has been has any issues with gay people. But as we discussed recently, since actor John Mahoney died, my hopes for a Frasier reboot have also passed away.
And also the dog's dead.
Oh shit.
Wow. All right. So that's my complicated this took a dark turn reading of Storm Spoilers reviews. Next segment,
nice.
Please.
All right, next segment is Neil's. We talked about this already, where we usually keep our Game of Thrones cornered, but this week it's just going to be some non-spoilery Game of Thrones tidbits and maybe some other cool things, right, Neil?
Yeah, there's a lot of things we've talked about previously. There's a lot of news related to some of the things that we talk about a lot. The first of which is Con of Thrones announced a new swath of guests, which includes Hannah Murray, who plays Gilly on the show. Is she the first cast member who's still on the show to actually? Oh no, the guy who played Jan Royce was last year. Mostly we've had the dead ones. Anyway, also the two fine folks from The Ringer's Binge Mode, Mallory and Jason,
yay,
confirmed to be there. Those are two people that I look forward to meeting and only really know through Twitter. And of course us, Storm of Spoilers. We were in the email, guys.
Yay! Announcement email.
We were in the email. Somehow they got decent photos of all three of us, which
I didn't know they took those photos, but they.
I knew signing that release would pay off.
They're definitely from the con last year, so good job.
And last but certainly not least is Paula Fairfield, the sound designer on Game of Thrones, who was there last year and was a huge hit, and is also just coming off this weekend. Won, was part of the team that won a Golden Reel Award from the Motion Picture Sound Editors. Thrones was 2 for 2 on awards. They won Outstanding Achievement in Sound Editing, Episodic Short Form, Effect, and Foley, which is the team that Paula Fairfield was on. They also won Outstanding Achievement in Sound Editing, Episodic Short Form, Dialogue, ADR. So both their sound effects and their redubbed dialogue. Top notch.
I know we've talked about this before, but that's a section we're in anyway, so that's fine. Last year at Con of Thrones, Paula met some of our friends who do like those live Con of Thrones reaction videos. What are those called again? I forget what they're called. They're named for the bar. Anyway, great.
Nope, can't think of it.
Great, great people. Maybe you want to Google it while I'm talking. Anyway, Paula met those people. They're so great. And so she decided to use them as the voice of the dying, the undead Viserion last year. And I wrote an article about it on VF. And
which is comes up first when you Google it.
House Burlington. That's who they are. The Burlington girls. I remembered it. I didn't Google it. I remembered it. I'm sorry that I forgot it. Anyway, Paula met them, liked them. They wound up on Game of Thrones last season because of it. Because of the freaking Con of Thrones. So I'm saying, come to Con of Thrones, meet Paula Fairfield. Even if she doesn't put you on Game of Thrones, she is an amazingly interesting human being to talk to. So it's going to be great times, guys. I'm really excited.
Yeah, super fun. Also, congratulations to her on her awesome award win. And the whole team. There's like 10 people that split these two awards. So it takes a lot of people to do all of that fun sound stuff. There was a toy fair this week, and some new Game of Thrones Funko Pop figures came out. This is a topic that is near and dear to me, as you may know throughout the years, because I also always anxiously await to see which of my favorite characters are going to get snubbed by Funko. But this year, we get a couple. We get a new Daenerys, which I believe is the 47th Daenerys figure.
Wow.
That they put out. This one is in her white coat. 47 is an exaggeration, but it's close. For the first time, I believe, Ser Davos, in his fancy hanging out with Jon gear.
Season 7
Jon Snow with his furs that fly. They apparently don't fly on the... Anyway, you get it. And Dany with their Dragonstone throne, which is pretty dope. So some new toys coming out for people like me who have a lot of Game of Thrones Funkos in their office.
Okay, oh my god, they released two Daenerys figures.
Yes, that's why I said. I mean,
jeepers! It's her on the throne, on her throne, and then. The white coat is maybe one of my favorite Game of Thrones costumes ever. So that's cool. Right. But
Still have the first Daenerys, which is her standing there holding one of the dragons. I think that was the first Daenerys.
Naked Funko Daenerys?
No, she's got clothes on.
I've got a Jon Snow and a Tyrion that were sent to me long ago, far away.
Specifically on my desk right now, I have Brienne and Tormund together. I have one full of arrows. And on the other side of my desk, I have Battle of the Bastards, Ramsay and Jon Snow, where Jon Snow's holding the bear shield and Ramsay's got his arrows. He's firing arrows at him. It's pretty great.
Oh, yeah. There's a white dress Daenerys, a dragon Daenerys, a blue dress Daenerys. Oh, my God, you guys. It's out of control.
Right.
All right.
You could have a lot of Daenerys's.
Wow.
The next thing we have is an update from old George, who I believe is still working on it.
Oh, I heard still that, working on I it. Heard that he was working on it. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, definitely working on it. Last week, where it came out, he confirmed in the comments that the next book that he will be releasing is Fire and Blood, which is this history of the Targaryens. So it's kind of like an addendum to Game of Thrones, or a side book, or a Cimmerillion-ish book. But we knew that. Like, we talked about this on the podcast before, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, a lot of people are treating this as new news, but this is not new news. We knew this. I think did he talk more about, like, the when of it?
It's this year.
This year. Later this year. Which he had already said. The first volume.
Late summer?
The first volume is this year. The second one has hardly begun.
So the second one is due. The earth may die before the second Fire and Blood comes out,
and then
or
Blood someone,
and Fire, or whatever it's called.
It's Fire and Blood, and then someone on Twitter that we follow was talking about how it would be illustrated, but I don't know where they sourced that quote. But like World of Ice and Fire is illustrated, and so I think this is sort of supposed to be similar to that.
Cool.
Perhaps.
I mean, I look forward to checking it out. But it doesn't mean that Winds of Winter got pushed any further back than it already is. So, like, that was something we knew was going to be in the way.
Yep.
So don't freak out, everybody. Don't freak out. And finally, last week, of course, we did a big Black Panther episode where we just loved Black Panther. That was last week, right?
Sure was.
Yeah.
Cool. I get my weeks mixed up.
No, it's okay. It took in as much as the entire domestic run of Justice League since we last talked.
So, yeah, it's an accelerated timetable on all counts. We did get a tweet from E. Webster, who responded to our Black Panther episode with, you guys forgot the most important part of Black Panther, which is the Black Panther knows how to run serpentine, unlike some people we could mention. Of course, referencing the unfortunate death of Rickon Stark, who ran in a straight line and got shot with arrows. And makes a great point, because there is that sequence where Black Panther is being shot at from above and runs in a serpentine, and guess what? Doesn't die. So there's that. Good place to end. Moving on.
It is important to run serpentine. All right. Mailbag episodes, as per usual, have come from you, the listeners, this week, with some finger on the scale tweeting from Joanna and I. That is going to, I guess, lay the track for our first non-Game of Thrones section, where we will be covering Legend of Zelda, the Olympics, Quantum Leap, good TV, and then, if we have time, a question about the Old Republic. Let's go with our first question here, which comes from, I believe comes from David V. Does this come from David V, or is this just a general question about Olympics?
This is a question that, we emailed ourselves.
Excellent. We emailed ourselves to talk about what is our favorite Olympic sport movie. Now, I have to ask some constraints here, because...
Okay.
Does an Olympic sport movie means it's about a sport that appears in the Winter Olympics, or appears in the Olympics?
Ooh, good question.
It have to be a movie that involves the Olympics somehow?
Are you asking about Munich?
I'm asking where Munich would fall, as opposed to something like the first Mighty Ducks, which is a national regional competition.
The Olympics has to be involved. So
okay.
Munich... Or
so
Mighty
the third
Ducks.
Third Mighty Ducks count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People on Twitter were saying it was Mighty Ducks 2. Is it Mighty Ducks 3 where they
go
to the Olympics?
I don't remember which. It's one of the sequels.
One of the Mighty Ducks sequels where the Olympics are involved, or Munich, are both Olympic movies under this category. But Mighty Ducks 1 is not. Mystery Alaska is not.
Sadly. Because that movie is awesome.
It's rad.
All right. I'm going to... I guess go first, because I really only have one answer, and that is the fantastic 1993 movie Cool Runnings about the Jamaican bobsled team, which is just as much a good feel good Walt Disney movie, as it is a nostalgia bump for me, a child watching movies in the 90s. And, you know, every once in a while, you just want to have a viewing of Cool Runnings.
A little,
feel
a little
the rhythm and feel the rhyme. And
a little,
it's bobsled time.
Dougie Doug in your life. Yeah.
Exactly.
Sorry.
But yeah, that's, I think that also goes about as far as I'm willing to go and towards that, like a traditional Disney Olympic storyline that is echoed through a lot of sports movies, which is maybe why I didn't get into more Olympic movies, but I'm sure you guys are going to have much better answers. Let's start with Neil.
Yes. I have two, maybe seven. No, just two. First of all, I'd like to give a shout to I, Tanya, which came out last year and is really good and really funny and really weird and is totally about the Winter Olympics, Tanya Harding. So you should see that. Didn't get as much award season love as it deserved, but
do you remember,
it's nominated for some things.
Do you remember which Winter Olympics that was?
That was in 90.
Do you remember the city?
Was it in Nagano?
No.
No, it was in Norway. Oslo?
Lillehammer.
Lillehammer. Okay.
I was playing this game with a friend of mine, because we're cool and play really cool games. While we were rewatching my favorite Olympic movie the other night, and she's really good at remembering summer Olympic cities, and I'm okay at remembering winter Olympic cities, and we tried to go back as far as we could, like naming the cities. Anyway, it's a fun mental exercise. See if you at home, see how far back you can go.
See how far back you can go.
I can go just before Lillehammer, and then I'm out, so.
Yeah, the winter ones are tough. Summer, I think, is easier. But really, the best movie is from 2004. It is about the 1980 Olympic men's hockey team. It stars one of the great humans we've ever produced, Kurt Russell. And it's called Miracle. It's a 2-hour-and-16-minute ode to the greatest moment in sports history, which I think is fantastic. One, because Kurt Russell's performance as Herb Brooks, as someone who grew up like really into hockey, like you got to know Herb Brooks and how he was, you know, he was kind of crazy. So Kurt Russell as Herb Brooks was just fantastic. But also all the young dudes who did a lot of their own hockey playing stunts and, you know, represented this, you know, super handsome, apparently, group of young men who toppled the Russians and defeated communism, like, for good.
Yeah, this is it.
It did not win Best Picture, but it did win, in 2004, the Best Sports Movie ESPY Awards.
Wow.
So, you know,
Two questions about Miracle.
Yes.
One, do you care to do your Al Michaels impression right now?
Oh my God, no way.
No?
But fun fact about that is that at the end of that movie, when he's doing the call, it cuts, I think you can tell, it cuts to the original audio of his call of that game, which is awesome. I cry literally every time I watch this movie.
It's really sweet. Number two, do you know where those Olympics took place?
Lake Placid.
Yeah, nailed it. All right.
Yeah, that one's easy.
Where the alligator was.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
The alligator was under the ice while they were like believing in miracles.
The only two that I remember was 1980 Lake Placid and 2002 Salt Lake City. And the 2002 one is only because every time I go to Sundance, I'm reminded of it, because they in Park City they still have all
the village
Olympic stuff.
Yeah, yeah. it's coming back to LA in like 2000 something.
Yeah,
20 something.
2024, I think.
Maybe. It's going. Anyway, sorry. This is boring. All right. My favorite. I rewatched it just the other night, just to make sure. I was rewatching a little bit of Miracle today, and I forgot how much that movie is like a dueling accents from like the handsome young men who are trying to be from Boston and the handsome young men who are trying to be from Minnesota. It's pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
But great. I like Miracle. That's not a knock on Miracle. Cutting Edge. The Cutting Edge. And honestly, Twitter, has responded very well to my cutting edge content over the last few days. So I think I'm not alone in this. The Cutting Edge is a romantic comedy from, I believe, 92. Like, I think it came out. It was either 92 or 94. It came out the year of A Winter Olympic. In 92, 94, I believe is when they switched from having things every 4 years to every 2 years. So there was a Winter Olympics in 92 and in 94. So I think that's why growing up, I thought like ice skating Olympics happen more often than they actually do. But yeah, it's a romantic comedy, I guess, about, you know, like an uptight career skater, and she's a para skater and she has to find someone and no one will work with her. It's basically Taming the Shrew. Her name's Kate. She's rich and uptight, and he's a hockey player and kind of loose, and they get together, they make magic on the ice. Like, he got injured, he can't play hockey, but it turns out he's a pretty good para skater. Game of Thrones trivia is that Roy Dotrice, who does the Game of Thrones audiobooks, plays their Russian coach, Pemchenko, and Terry O'Quinn of Lost fame plays Kate's father. And it is a great, great romantic comedy / sports film, like all wrapped up into one. So
yeah, it's like the best movie if you're watching the Olympics with your significant other and you realize that like curling is ready to go into like its fourth hour. You just turn that on. It's a win for everybody.
Yeah, it's got the sports movie stuff for the sports movie people, the rom-com stuff for the rom-com people, and tequila shots for the rest of us. Dave, two questions.
Yeah.
Number one, do you have any feelings on the film The Cutting Edge? Number two, when I mentioned that I kind of wanted to do a little bit of Olympic segment on the podcast this week, you were like a smidge resistant. And so I was just wondering if you could, talk about your cutting edge feelings, if you have any, maybe not, and B, your general Olympics feelings.
Sure. Don't really remember Cutting Edge, but when you said it was just the Taming of the Shrew, a little light went off in my brain. So maybe I should go back and revisit Cutting Edge. But it was definitely something I saw when I was younger and was fine with it. But I think I'm confusing a lot of it with Strictly Ballroom, which also makes for a crazy movie in your head, but not necessarily one that ever existed. And for the thing about, I don't know, don't you guys get kind of salty when culture makes you care about sporting events? Apparently not like all the time, but that's what some people I imagine feel like around Super Bowl time, or anytime there's a mass leaning, World Cup time occasionally, there's a mass leaning where it's like you can't go to the grocery store without somebody having an opinion about something that's on and it's a sporting event. I feel weird about it.
So
it's not against people who enjoy watching that. And, you know, I'm not, people pretend to be like weird experts on sports, no matter what it is. So I don't, it's not about people watching it. It's about the assumption that I care about it.
Neil is, our friend Neil Miller is a year round sports fan.
I'm a sports person.
You're a sports person.
Yeah.
I am an only high stakes sports person. So I only like the Super Bowl, and not all of the Super Bowl. I only like the last quarter of the Super Bowl. I love the World Cup. I love the Olympics. That because the reason I love it, it's not because I care about sports, which I mean, I get the appeal of sports. I'm not knocking sports, but like I care about this like pressurized like situation where you've been practicing your whole life for this moment, and any little slip up in a moment could change it. And not because like it's not a schadenfreude, like I want to see them fail. It's just sort of like I get really excited when they do well, and I really admire the grace under pressure that so many people exhibit. So yeah, I'm really into those things that you're talking about.
You're into the drama of it.
I am into the drama of it.
Me
right,
too.
And I don't. I totally get into. And for me, that happens on a regional level. So for me, when I get into sports, it's because I'm with somebody that I like that is into sports, and that makes it super enjoyable for me. I just don't like the idea that there are like these huge mass events that, like, I don't know. I like the idea of the Olympics of being like everybody throw your best into the ring and let's have them compete. But for me, that only really manifests in like the Summer Olympics. Like figure skating and hockey used to be in there. It wasn't until the 1920s we decided to split it off, usually for monetary reasons. Only like 14 to 21 countries who ever enter it have ever won a medal in the Winter Olympics, because all the sports, quote unquote, depending on how you define it, involve putting dangerous things on your body and going into the cold at high speeds, which is great, but it's something different than I think like endurance test running or, you know, more traditional Olympic sports.
Yeah.
Again, not trying to pass judgment. It's just not for me. It's so not for me.
We just have to reframe the way you look at the Winter Olympics, because yes, the Summer Olympics are, I feel like, the complete opposite way. Where it's like the Summer Olympics, it's like who can run fastest, who can jump highest. Sure. Like we decided that on the playground in like fourth grade. Those are all great sports. And basketball, obviously, huge mad props to basketball. But the Winter Olympics, almost to a sport, with the exception of curling, which you can do drunk, by the way, they had to add that one. All of the sports in the Winter Olympics are like, try and do this and don't die. Like, try and go down this hill as fast as possible. Don't die.
Here, put these knives on your shoes.
Try and jump off this ski lift.
And stamp
right
on
ice.
Okay,
fun story. Did I tell you guys about the ski jumpers? And why they actively try to get jet lag? So there's a story, I think it was in the New York Times, about ski jumpers and how they actively try to be jet lagged when they're about to perform, because it dulls the senses, because the act of ski jumping is as close to killing yourself as you can get without killing yourself. That's how a ski jumper described why they like to have their senses dulled when they're about to do this competition. That's why I love the Winter Olympics.
Here, let me, I guess, bring up something that I have noticed from this Olympics and maybe sort of is applicable to what we're talking about.
America sucks.
Elizabeth Sweeney of the Hungarian Olympic team did a ski
half-pipe
run with no... Well, here's the thing. First of all, she didn't fall down, so, you know, in some sense, she succeeded. But in the other sense...
She should really be our favorite.
All it is strapping things to your body and going into a potentially dangerous situation that seems like a weird non-sport. Like
the Darwin Awards of sports, though. Like, that's the best thing about it, is at any moment someone could die, and on the whole they don't, which is fantastic.
I mean that's why I watched like 3 seasons of Survivor, not necessarily the Winter Olympics.
I know I asked for this. I knew you didn't like them, and I asked you to tell me why. I did this to myself. These are the last two things that I will say about the Olympics before we move on, if we want to. One is that I'm so deeply into the whole Adam Rippon phenomenon. It's ridiculous. I know that makes me like a basic bitch because like everyone's into Adam Rippon, but I am too. And then everyone also is obviously into Tessa Virtue and Scott Moir, are the Canadian pair skaters who just won like a record third gold medal, I think, for pair skating.
Whose whole thing is basically softcore.
Are they fucking? The Deadspin literally has an article up that says, "Are Virtue and Moir fucking or what?" Is the headline. Here's my "Are Virtue and Moir fucking or what?" Conspiracy thing. I mean, like, we started as a Game of Thrones crackpot theorist podcast. This is what I'll say. I believe Scott, Virtue and Moir, who have been skating together for 20 years, since they were children, really want to bone. And I think that desire to bone is what makes their skating so good. So I believe that for as long as they've been like not since children, but since they were old enough to like be consenting adults-ish and fucking, they've decided not to because it would ruin their skating. So
interesting.
I believe they have been wanting to, but have been holding up. Because there's no, I mean, like, if Scott Moir were gay or if she were gay or whatever, I'd be like, okay, whatever. But, you know, they're heterosexual adults who, like, talk, when you hear them talk about each other, it's like bananas in terms of how much they care about each other. And that doesn't necessarily mean you want to fuck someone just because you care about them so much. But they're also, like, just smoking hot humans. And they, like, anyway, whatever. Point being, I believe after they won their gold medal last night, and that's it for them. They're out. They're not going to skate. They're not going to do Olympics anymore. My prediction is that they boned last night. So,
wow.
That's my crackpot theory about Virtue
Moore.
That's a great
Olympics crackpot theory.
I think they had so much athletic sex last night. That's what I think. Go, oh, man. Canada. All right.
There is a movie called The Bronze.
Yeah.
Which is a bad movie about...
What's her name? Melissa Rauch? Is that her name?
Yeah. And Sebastian Stan in another figure skating movie. That has one of the most hilarious sex scenes I've ever seen, because it's obvious body doubles, and it's supposed to be Melissa Rauch and Sebastian Stan, but it's two body doubles who look like bodybuilders. Wow. And they're doing the most athletic things you can think of. So now that's all I can think of, thanks to that whole theory.
Olympic Village sex.
Awesome.
The best of sexes.
I mean, it's the most frequent of sexes, from what I understand.
It is now.
Yeah, they have to get out condoms and everything.
So anyway, watch the Winter Olympics. They're fun.
Yeah. We just found several ways to be sexy about them and one way not to like them, all of which super valid. good job, team. Team at Storm of Spoilers. All right. An email from David V that I might have propped it through Twitter. Can you talk about the world building in The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild? I thought it was incredibly well done, especially considering the nonlinear storytelling it employs.
Wait, sorry.
Yeah.
Can you tell our listeners who might not be familiar what this Zelda game is?
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay, so Zelda Breath of the Wild is the newest Zelda game for Nintendo Switch. It's incredibly well-selling, both the system and the game. It's been heralded as the best game of the year last year by many publications, and some places like Polygon, I think, even said the best game of the decade. It is, like all Zelda games, you are a dude named Link who is trying to save a princess who is fighting an evil force named Ganon, who sort of looks like a pig. But the thing about this game is it is open world, and you can wander around and sort of create your own story as you go. So as soon as you're done with a tutorial section at the beginning, you go immediately to Ganon and skip all the games. Or you could do like I did and run around for over 100 hours and find every shrine in the game and get all the collectibles and stuff. But the thing that I found most interesting about this form of Zelda is that Zelda is usually a quest-based game. Or if you've played any, I guess, JRPGs, your Final Fantasies, your whatnot, those are all similarly quest-based games where you're telling a story and you have to go get an object or get a person and take them to a place where another part of the story happens. Breath of the Wild, the new Zelda game, is a systemic-based storytelling game, which is really interesting. It's a really interesting way to make a game, and I think thinking about it is an interesting thing to apply to world building. So if you're thinking about whether it be like Westeros or Star Wars or Star Trek, the things that make a systemic game work are also the same things that make a cohesive world building work. So how a systemic game works and how Legend of Zelda works is you have everything that's in a game that's a non-player object has a system of inputs and outputs, but they're allowed to recognize each other in the game. So enemies are allowed to recognize villagers. Villagers are allowed to recognize rocks. Rocks could recognize whether the wind is blowing, whether it's raining outside, and all these systems and mechanics stack up on top of each other. And then you add some very, very basic rules. Things that are made out of wood light on fire if they're near fire. Humans don't like to be in the rain, so they're going to run for cover if it rains. Monsters like to sleep in the early morning hours of the day. All of these rules and systems combine to create a world that actually doesn't need you to interact with it in order to be interacting with itself. The way that story is created in these sort of games is, I think it's called emergent storytelling. But the idea is you put enough of these systems in one place that by the time that the player enters it, they're going to create their own stories just by interacting with the environment. To take this out of Legend of Zelda and put it into something like Game of Thrones, in order to infiltrate Dorne as a one-handed man, you're going to need a costume. You can stop a sword with that hand. You're going to maybe have to battle people in some beautiful gardens that you have to find. But the process of actually thinking your way into your own plot through some systems is how the plot is built. Instead of like a go save the princess, you have to get the 5 jewels before you could get the key to the lock to the blah, 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 which is how we're used to playing games. So I think the best part about playing Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild wasn't so much finishing it as seeing how all the systems piled on top of each other to create things like different races with different purposes that act differently around enemies or foreigners or people in disguise that are actually enemies that are on different parts of the path pretending to be merchants. All of these little levels where you only have to come up with the idea of something gets turned into a plot or story by its systematic interactions. So in something, again, like Game of Thrones, it's important to know that the concept of the Gold Cloaks exists for 7 seasons, even though we won't see them until the final season, because the idea of somebody not breaking their contract but also being hireable for gold is an important balance to measure other systems, both of loyalty and of sell swords, up against whatever the actual plot's going to be interacting with. So I guess that was a monologue way of talking about why talking about Zelda is also talking about Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
But hopefully it's a good way of...
Important question. So Zelda's the princess, right?
Yes.
And Link, okay. Link is the little
Azure dude.
This is like a Frankenstein's monster sort of situation. I think so many people who never played Zelda think that that Link is named Zelda.
It's hard.
Oh, yeah, Zelda's the boy is a good meme that really peaked in late 2017. But yeah, Link is the boy. The best way to remember that is he's always the link between cultures and worlds in the game.
Whoa.
He's the one that could move in between those things without being judged.
So I have a question for you, Dave. Yeah. Like, besides Prince Sidon, who are your favorite side characters?
Oh, you're going to go through all this, this things. I didn't get super, super involved, in the side characters, but I do have to say, having farmed a lot of materials, I'm partial to Beetle. You know exactly what that means, right, Joanna?
Absolutely. What are your preferred weapons, armor, and why?
I like swords that allow me to use shields. I'm not a big fan of the double-handed ones, and my favorite armor is my amiibo armor for the Hero of Time.
Do you have a favorite or like least favorite enemy?
I like fighting Lynels because I hate fighting Lynels.
which part of the game did you which part of the game did you find hardest to overcome? No follow-ups.
The quest where you have to go to the island and it takes all of your items away from you and you have to fight a whole bunch of stuff and solve a ball puzzle. I have no non-dirty way of putting that.
This is sort of like the classic interview question. It's like, what is your biggest flaw? What do you think the game's shortcomings are, if any?
The conclusion to the actual plot has to be made in case you didn't go through all of it. So there's a possibility that you don't find all the memories and miss how nice it is to have voice-acted Zelda cutaways, and in which case the final line of the game is probably disappointing to you.
All right. Last question. I really hate to leave this subject, but like, do you agree that Breath of the Wild is the best installment in the Legend of Zelda series?
Maybe. It's as important to gaming as Ocarina of Time was to redefining 3D gaming, so I don't know what best. It's pretty damn good.
Awesome.
This is the saltiest burrito.
Neil, did you have any other
mailbag segment?
Did you have any other Zelda questions?
No, I will say this though. I played Zelda for 20 minutes once when I was in middle school, and it's a dope game. And also, I have not bought a Nintendo Switch because I have severe OCD, and there would be no way that I would start an open world game like that and ever do anything else until it was finished. So I'm glad that I could just listen to Dave talk about it instead of play it, because that would be a lot of time that I would not get back.
Dave. I also read a really good thesis paper on systemic gaming today to prepare for that. So if you Google systemic gaming and click on some of the PDFs, I would check those out.
Is there anything else you want to say about Zelda, Dave, that I didn't give you a chance to say?
No, I think that was pretty good. I'm just glad I got to talk about it, because the only other person I could talk about it with is David Ehrlich on my other podcast, and he's at a goddamn film festival.
Berlin, so
I can't talk to him about Legend of Zelda.
If you want to talk to Dave Gonzalez about Legend of Zelda, you can tweet him at DA70, and he will be here for all of your questions. Yeah?
You kind of sound like you want to read this next question, Joanna.
I don't really want to, because that don't look too self-serving, because it's a question for me. So let's do as more general.
I'll read this one.
Okay.
I'll read the next, because this is, you know, we might as well get the special interest questions out of the way here. this is an email from Jeff B. I've been wondering, with all these 80s, 90s reboots, that actually is a good callback to a previous episode, if Quantum Leap will ever get revived, and if I'd even want that. How could they do it? Would they have to update it? Gen X Dr. Sam Beckett doesn't sound as interesting, and a millennial one sounds insufferable, and even more pandering than the original was to the baby boomers. If they did bring it back, who would you cast? Maybe even consider it might be fun to switch Sam and Al's personalities and gender swap too. Okay, Joanna, you are, as Jeff put in the part of the email that I didn't copy, our resident Quantum Leaper.
Tell us about
your Quantum Leap reboot.
Well, first we should say that the creator of Quantum Leap has written a film script. So though there isn't a plan currently to do...
Wait, is it a continuation or is it a new... Is it its own thing?
Let us see what he says about it. I just finished writing a Quantum Leap feature. I don't know what's going to happen with it, but I did write it. I just put Scott Bakula and Dean Stockwell in my head, kind of rebooted them and went from there.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Jeff asked who he would cast. Here's my dream cast for a Quantum Leap reboot. Are you ready?
Yes.
The idea, if you don't know, of Quantum Leap is that Dr. Sam Beckett, trying to see if time travel would work within one's own lifetime, Dr. Sam Beckett stepped into a quantum leap accelerator and vanished. He awoke to find himself trapped in the past, facing mirror images that were not his own and driven by an unknown force to change history for the better. His only guide on this journey is Al, an observer from his own time who appears in the form of a hologram that only Sam can see and hear. And so Dr. Beckett finds himself leaping from life to life, striving to put right what once went wrong and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home.
And so, it never is.
Right. So
spoilers.
The idea is, like, you know, each episode Scott Bakula, who's great, fantastic, would be in a different person's body, and though he wouldn't take on that person's personality, because like the comedy of it was like he had to sort of fumble through this person's life as himself and getting context clues as to where he is and what's going on. And he had to fix some mistake that happened in this person's life. And once he did, he was able to move on. So even though he's not really required to be a chameleon in this role, I was like, how fun would it be to cast a chameleon? So I say we put Tatiana Maslany in Quantum Leap. And maybe it would be fun to watch her like trying a little harder to sort of fit into the world that she has leaped into. The reason why Quantum Leap reboot might be kind of fun is so Dr. Sam Beckett could only travel along the time, back in time along his own personal lifespan. And if we were to reboot this with a younger person, that would mean it could take advantage of like some of that recency nostalgia that we are really into, like thinking OJ and Tonya Harding and stuff like that. So that could be kind of fun. For Al, who's, you know, Dean Stockwell played Al so well as this hologram helping Sam Beckett, I would put Scott Bakula in that role, actually. So cast Scott Bakula as Al, but like cast him as Dr. Sam Beckett, who's gone home and is now helping this new Leaper, and cast Tatiana Maslany as the new Leaper. That would be my advice.
Wait.
Yeah.
No. No, that would work. Never mind.
Could you imagine the 9/11 episode? That'd be weird.
Oh, that'd be a lot. Yeah, so.
Maybe they would just be Charlie Sheen in a movie about 9/11.
Oh, that'd be even worse.
I was really into time travel TV shows when I was younger. So Quantum Leap was one that I really loved, and Highlander is another one. It's not really time travel, but takes place throughout history. Anyway. Jeff also kindly asked, did you guys watch Quantum Leap? And B, do you have any like rebooting or casting feelings about it?
I have nothing to add that I am more enthusiastic about than what you said. I think you did really well considering my knowledge of Quantum Leap.
Thank you. Neil?
Wasn't there a Quantum Leap joke in a recent movie or TV show?
Maybe.
That's the most I know.
Really? You never saw Quantum Leap?
Oh. No.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I did not.
We should have a wheel of things that Neil needs to watch.
Yeah.
They're just like fun and one shots. A little bit of Quantum Leap, a little bit of Early Edition.
Oh, Early Edition. I loved that show.
A lot of your righteous white guys. Fix people's lives.
Oh, they're earnest and righteous at the same time.
Yes.
Jeff asked my favorite Quantum Leap episode, or our favorite, but I guess probably I'm going to be the one to answer this. My answer is kind of complicated. First of all, I want to mention this. Every time at the end of every episode of Quantum Leap, Sam would leap into his new body. So you get like a built-in teaser for what next week is going to be. So he would like leap, and then he would like look around and like see where he was and realize the perilous position he's put himself in. And so his catchphrase for that was, oh boy. He would always go, oh boy, like wherever he was. Except my favorite one where he leaps into a rabbi and he goes, oy vey, I'm the rabbi. All right. It sounds worse than it was, but it's pretty bad. My favorite, like my kind of joke answer for my favorite Quantum Leap is this one called Catch a Falling Star, where he leaps into an actor who's doing Man of La Mancha, and Scott Bakula can sing. It's a musical episode of Quantum Leap. Scott Bakula can sing. He's the lead in the musical Man of La Mancha. Sam Beckett has an eidetic memory, so he can memorize his lines really quickly. That's where I learned what an eidetic memory was and stuff like that. So, there's that episode. There's the pool episode, which I think Dave Gonzalez would really like, where Al uses his like hologram abilities to show Sam exactly where to hit the ball with the pool cue to get the angles right to like get all the balls in the pocket. But the real answer is the best one is called The Leap Home Part 1 and Part 2, where Sam leaps, season 3, Sam leaps into himself and then his brother who died in Vietnam. And it is really, 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 really good. And like leaps into his boyhood self. And he plays Imagine on the guitar for his sister by John Lennon. And she freaks out because that song had not been written yet. Anyway, it's really, really good. And Quantum Leap is a great show, albeit quite often a cheesy show. But I think a reboot is something that I think could be successful. So,
I found the joke that I was mentioning earlier.
What was it?
It was on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, okay. An episode called The Gang Turns Black, where they get body swapped into the bodies of five black people, and then they run across Scott Bakula, and he sings a song about Quantum Leap. So look that up if you.
That's delightful.
Have a minute. That's my contribution to this.
Do you guys have any? Well, here's my question: since you guys don't have any like strong Quantum Leap feelings or any Quantum Leap feelings, do you have any Scott Bakula feelings? Like, do you get it?
He's
like, because I know
CSI, right?
I don't want to know what he's doing these days, but like, he he was a Star Trek Starfleet captain. Do you like do you get excited when you see Scott Bakula the same way I do, or do you are you like super neutral on him?
He did transition from Quantum Leap guy to Captain Archer for me with Enterprise, but that's because he came into my house and I had to accept him as having always been there. And he did a pretty good job after they figured out what that show wanted to be. And the nice thing about that show is even when it was bad and people were hating on it, Scott Bakula was 1,000% into being a Star Trek captain. So I'll always give him the You're Not William Shatner Award, which is an actual award for being a good person and a good Star Trek captain.
Awesome. Neil, do you have any Scott Bakula feelings?
I don't really.
Okay.
Because I did not watch Star Trek Enterprise. I did, however, when I Googled Scott Bakula, wonder very strongly why under the people also search for it was his wife Dean Stockwell and Lucas Black from Fast and the Furious. Turns out they're both on NCIS New Orleans, which is something I didn't know until now. So
wait,
there you go.
here's some Scott Bakula trivia for you. When did the original Mr. and Mrs. Smith come out, like the movie? 2005. For some reason, I blanked on the fact that Mr. and Mrs. Smith is the name of a 1996 TV series starring Maria Bello and Scott Bakula as two spies who are recruited to an intelligence agency. They pose as a married couple, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, when they are on missions. So it wasn't like the same premise, but pretty similar. Also, weirdly, Roy Dotrice of Game of Thrones audiobook fame was in that. All right, let's move on.
It's really just a long way to go to talk about Roy Dotrice.
As much as possible. Rest in peace, Fred.
If he was in Cool Runnings, then really we'd have a phenomenon in our hand. All right. Email from Christy involves two questions. Question the first. What TV shows have you started to watch only because of the actors in them? I loved Michael Emerson and Lost so much that I started watching Person of Interest when it came out just for him. I have no idea what the initial reviews said about the show. That was worth it. I started watching Powerless because it had Danny Pudi, Ron Fuchs, and Alan Tudyk. That one was not worth it. I also convinced a friend to watch Flash Forward because insert name of actor who played Gaius Baltar on Battlestar Galactica had a small, hilarious role in the show. Guys, outside of naming the Prince of Dorn...
It's not the same. Though it's very close. I get them confused.
King of Dorn? No, it is. You're right. It's not the same guy.
It's not the same guy.
The doctor from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
What happened to Gaius Baltar?
Gaius Baltar, James Callis, who's also Tom from the Bridget Jones film franchise. I forever get Gaius Baltar and Dr. Julian Bashir. Like, in my head, they're linked as well. So you're not alone in that. But James Callis, what is James Callis doing these days?
That's a good question.
I mean, he's the voice in the Netflix series Castlevania. So
all right.
He's got that going for him, which
that's
is nice.
He and Trisha Helfer did a Rick and Morty episode.
It's good. Also good.
What TV shows
you started watching just because of some actor that was in it?
All mine are Game of Thrones related.
Okay, let's hear it.
I watched the first season of Narcos
because
There was also something Natalie Dormer related that I'm looking up right now because I can't remember what it was. Because I'm pro Natalie Dormer, obviously.
After Game of Thrones? Or did you try to watch The Tudors to get
it?
Like,
was something. It was something that had come out before. It might have been The Tudors. Yes, it was The Tudors.
I will. Okay. I'll give an answer, which is this. I started watching the ABC sitcom Selfie because I liked Karen Gillan from Doctor Who and John Cho so much. And when I started watching it, it was not good. And then it got really good, and then it got canceled. So Selfie is a show that like I stuck with longer than I normally would have because I liked those lead actors so much. And then they figured out what made those lead actors so good. And by the time they figured it out, though, it was too late. So rest in peace, Selfie. But that's a show I watched for those people alone. Dave?
Hmm. Love American Horror Story for being ridiculous. You could hear on our Storm of Spoilers American Horror Story episode. But started watching that show and Nashville, even though I didn't stick with Nashville, following Connie Britton.
Yeah, I
would still follow Connie Britton to all of her bullshit, whatever.
That's happened to me a lot with Game of Thrones, with the Friday Night Lights people. Like, everything that Matt Saracen has done post Friday Night Lights has been bad. Like, he did that Doctor show and a couple Doctor shows, right? Because he was a Mob Doctor, and then he was the one that was like off the map or whatever it was, which was an ABC medical show. I followed Tim Riggins wherever he goes, for better or for worse.
You went to Mars for Tim Riggins.
I went all the way to Barsoom for Tim Riggins, and then I started watching Heart of Dixie for Jason Street, and actually I have no regrets about that. Heart of Dixie was a very charming show that people think is stupid, but it's not. So there you go.
I also watched the NBC sitcom You, Me, and the Apocalypse because it had Jenna Fisher in it. That was not great. It also had Rob Lowe. You'd think Rob Lowe plays basically the Pope.
I thought that show had like good parts to it, you know.
It had good parts, but it wasn't great.
It was just super weird because it was like a high, it was like a crossover British American TV show, and like those sensibilities, no matter how modern we get and how much like social media and the internet flattens us all out into the same culture, British humor and American humor is still kind of clashes, I think. So, yeah. All right.
Well, on the topic of shows that aren't all good or all bad, question the second.
Yeah.
What TV shows were ruined by their endings so that it changed your mind about the whole series? You, one of you, mentioned that the character assassination of Jim from The Office spoiled the series somewhat. That was Joanna. For me, the ending of How I Met Your Mother sat so wrong that I don't even want to stumble across a rerun of it. The last couple of seasons weren't the strongest, but I could usually count on Barney to keep it fun. And then that last episode, ugh. Yes, Christy, I also feel your pain. Even that last season, we were stuck in that wedding hotel for week after week, and I was still trying to hold it through ukulele performances of La Vie en Rose, and it's still just like bombed.
Remember
in the middle of my face.
Remember how they did a whole rhyming episode, and even though Lin-Manuel Miranda was in it, it still wasn't good.
Yeah, there's just everything about how I Met Your Mother closed out was bad, and then now the Me Too movement has revealed the entire show was 90% garbage people.
Yeah.
So like Seinfeld before it, people who are in their 20s in New York equal mostly garbage people. That's my backstory. Guys, any other shows that have been ruined by the finales for you? Let's go for specifically ruined. I don't know if there's anything that's going to pivot to the better from the end, right?
Yeah.
See, it's tough because there's two come to mind for me. One is Dexter, which I never finished.
Oh, you stole mine. It's Dexter.
But see, it's for a different reason. Like, Dexter just lost me with like several seasons to go. Like, I think the last episode I watched was the episode where they found the baby in the bathroom sitting in a pool of blood. And I was like, yeah, I'm done. I feel like I've reached the end. I would also now like to give the least hot of the all-time hot takes and say that I don't think it ruined it, but it definitely changed how I felt about it, and that was the finale of Lost. Like, that show was really good. I mean, it had some weird seasons, but up to the end, I was on board. Like, I was one of those people who, toward the end of Lost, was like, no, guys, they're not going to all be dead. And they're going to find a creative way to finish this. And I was wrong. So, you know, spoilers for Lost, I guess.
I am going to throw one more on the fire before we hear from Dave, because Dexter was stolen from me. And if you didn't suffer through that finale, then man. Okay, but if you ever... I'm sure I've mentioned this on the show before. I know I have, because we talked about it, we three of us. But like, go ahead and Google like Harrison Treadmill Dexter for the best GIF you've ever seen in your entire life. Google, I think it was Dustin's recap on Up Rocks of the finale of Dexter, because it's so angry and hilarious. But I will throw Roseanne on this fire and nice. Say the concept of the Connor family both winning the lottery and then revealing that that was like a coping mechanism for the loss of Dan Connor. Just terrible. All terrible ideas. All terrible, terrible ideas to like just lose complete control of your premise. So, yeah, Roseanne is my vote. Dave, is there anything else you want to say?
It didn't ruin everything for me, but I did wish I could take back the majority of the last season of Battlestar Galactica when it ended up being that God did it. Just because God did it is really lame, especially when there was a lot of times they could have dealt with the God did it question and specifically sidestepped it to not do that. That it felt like a really horrible way out. I like how all the characters except for Starbuck end up, but the arch plot... it was a road to nowhere.
Right. So if you listeners are like, can't believe you forgot this show that ended terribly, let us know, right?
Yeah. That Blue Mountain State College show I never watched probably ended and probably wasn't good. Tell me about it.
But some shows are bad from the start.
Yeah, no, I would be interested if there's somebody who's like, listen, this show was horrible, but then the ending, like, did a good place and recontextualized it for me. I'd be interested if that exists. I don't think it does, but that would be cool. It'd be cool if there was, like, a reverse selfie. All right. We're going to go with this really fast. Hey, Josh D. emailed a question for me. I'm unabashed Star Wars Old Republic fan. Both Knights games are some of my all-time favorites. I've even played the MMO, tabletop RPG setting, and so forth. Do you think there's any chance for an Old Republic show or movie or cartoon or something in the future? I feel like it could make for a fun cartoon personally, but maybe the story is already told. Should I give up hope? No, Josh, don't give up hope. You're all going to have to wait
a
while,
question.
Though.
What is the Old... So the Old Republic is just a thing. It's video games and stuff that were set like way far back.
I really like this. We're like, wait, Dave, what is this thing you're talking about?
I was just gonna blow through it really
like
quick.
I'm aware of Old Republic and how like it's super popular with Star Wars fans, but I don't actually know what it is.
Yeah, so it's set hundreds of years before episode one, during the Sith Wars, when the Sith aren't just like anti-Jedi, they're a race of people, and a whole bunch of stuff is set around there. So it's familiar tropes like speed bike racing sort of takes over pod racing, but the same sort of ideas of a big evil thing and a good republic and then a whole bunch of smugglers and droids in the middle. It was created around the 90s, the late 90s, early 2000s, while George Lucas was creating the prequel trilogy as sort of creating a new world where people could make games and not fuck with George Lucas's precious continuity. So when Disney bought it, it got deleted with everything else because it was just created to be extraneous in the first place. But they have been dropping hints to some popular characters from that series in various related media. Darth Revan, who's probably the most popular character from the Knights of the Old Republic games, it almost appeared in Star Wars Rebels, but they took him out like the last time. Oh, I'm sorry, Star Wars Clone Wars, but they took him out the last minute. So they've been waiting about reintroducing the idea that this period of time existed. The reason I'm going to tell Josh to maybe wait a little bit is when Disney first got Star Wars, they're like, we're going to do another trilogy of movies, and we're going to do spinoff films. We're just now seeing with the announcement of Weiss and Benioff and Rian Johnson getting new series that they actually plan to take the Star Wars property and move it into worlds that are outside of George Lucas's Skywalker saga. So I think those places are great places where people can create their own IP that Disney can make money off of for decades without necessarily clashing with some of these sacrosanct Star Wars things. So I think it's only a matter of time before someone's willing to go back to the Old Republic. I still think it'd be a great thing for Weiss and Benioff to do a series of, but we haven't heard anything official yet. I just don't give up hope. There's a lot of good stuff in the Old Republic that could come back.
Don't give up hope, Josh. Stay with us.
Hope. And with that, blurting of hope, we're going to transition into the spoilery part of our podcast, where we're going to talk about some theories about Game of Thrones Season 8 and some spoilery news we've happened across. So, guys, if you do not want to be spoiled for Game of Thrones upcoming season, which comes out next spring, jump off now. But otherwise, if you're still here, you're Stormborn. Neil.
Yes.
What's up in this section?
Okay, so a couple weeks ago, we talked about the news that Winterfell would be on fire at some point during Season 8, and we asked people to send us their theories. Mm-hmm. We did receive a lot of emails about this, and a lot of them were a variant of one particular theory, which I will illustrate momentarily. First, I wanted to read a small bit of an email from Pat, our good friend Pat, who's a longtime listener, who had the most unique theory, and it goes as follows. I'm choosing to believe that Winterfell is not going to be set on fire this season. I believe that now that the filming of the series is done, they decided to burn those sets, hoping that people would spread the word and articulate that Winterfell will go up in flames this season when it won't. Pat, love your energy here. But I think that there's two problems with this. One, I feel like if they're going to take down a set, burning it is a really extreme way to go. Also, we've been burned previously attributing trolly things to the Game of Thrones production. Although, you know, having Sybil Kakeli on set one day last year was...
in costume.
You know, that was pretty solid. But they don't... As much as we think they're messing with us, I don't think they're messing with us. The second thing is, why would they destroy those sets? Those are humongous tourist things that they can have for many years. And then when they do the prequel series, Winterfell exists for many thousands of years, hundreds of years at least. So if they're doing series that are set in Westeros, they may need those. So I want to believe that it has something to do with being filmed burning. So on that, we have an email from Tom. Tom pretty much sums up the bulk of the emails we got about this, in which he says, Tyrion borrows from one of his hard lessons from last season and helps advise the prickly troika of Jon, Dany, and Sansa to evacuate Winterfell, lure the army of the dead to lay siege, and then torch the whole lot. This ploy would still allow for a major aerial battle while still requiring significant ground forces. One advantage in this option is efficiency. There would be plenty of room for scheming and character interactions we care about while having a single battle royale in the north versus Winterfell getting sacked and then a second battle for the whole of the north somewhere else. So this idea that what happened, someone figures out that the Army of the Dead is coming, and they decide that they can't outlast a siege because they don't have enough grain, even though Sansa was doing a very dutiful job of getting all the grain in the right places. And they decide to maybe empty out Winterfell, lure in the Army of the Dead, and then try and light them on fire. Not a bad idea. What do you guys think about this theory?
As I think you said, like, we had a lot of variations on this idea that the burning of Winterfell would be an intentional sort of move to try to wipe out at least some of the whites. Sure. Yeah. I mean, here's what I'll say. I really need Tyrion to have a good idea and execute it next season. That is something we haven't seen for a while, and I need to see. Right?
This feels like something that could have a mild historical basis. I'm just not knowledgeable enough about the Middle Ages to like pull it off. But this that's what makes me think that it's possible. Is like, this sounds like an in-world solution that somebody would pick up. And then I like the combination the connection that Tom makes, that way you don't have to have a split narrative battle where it's like, once again, they're running from the thing and then they're running to the other thing. You just have a gambit. You have an opening gambit on how to even the ranks a little bit.
Yeah, and one of our other emailers, whose name I forget, I apologize, made the same pitch but with more militaristic terms, in the sense that like basically like getting out of Winterfell and letting it like basically be taken very easily and letting the whites in would create like a kill zone where, you know, say they're everybody, all these whites are stuffed into the courtyard at Winterfell and a dragon flies over them and roasts them. There's nowhere for them to go. So there's probably a bunch of different like ancient
military
things.
So that moat
that
we saw would be to keep people in just as much as keeping people out.
Yeah because maybe. Whites can't swim.
Not all even right. Through a moat.
1-1 to the sea. All right.
This all ends at River Run. Now that we have to refresh that theory.
Well, okay. So this brings me to the next thing. I don't want to. Let me check the notes to make sure I'm not like zooming forward. Yeah. Okay. This goes to the next spoiler thing we're going to reveal. Are people ready for this? Okay.
I've been ready.
Really? Are you ready? Are you really sure you want to listen to this, guys? All right, here we go.
This one's big.
This one's big.
Yeah.
This one, paparazzi or like drone, whatever. Photos on set capture what appears to be, unless it's one of those fake scenes they're filming to fool us all, Jon Snow taking the knee in front, bending the knee to Cersei Lannister. So... I don't know if you guys remember, but bending the knee was a big deal in season 7. So maybe a theory is...
Until it wasn't.
Maybe a theory is this. Maybe a theory is they have to burn Winterfell as a tactical move. That's going to force them south, because they're not going to take out everyone in the burning of Winterfell. But, you know, maybe do put some dent in the Night King's forces, push them south, and so they're going to come down to King's Landing, and they're going to have no choice but to ask Cersei for help. And they're going to be like, the zombies are right behind us. We know you have to join forces with us now. Listen, they're right over there. And she's like, LOL, I have gold cloaks. I don't have to do anything. But we'll see. But that would require then Jon to bend the knee to ask for help. But either way, like whether tactical or no, the burning of Winterfell would push Jon into Jon finding out the wall is breached and Winterfell burning would push Jon into a position where he might be forced to ask Cersei for help.
Which is that feels kind of easy from a storytelling perspective, because there are other castles in Westeros that are just as strong, if not much stronger, than King's Landing. So I guess at that point he would be going to her for like military help. So we would have to kind of, assume that a lot of people die in the first battle.
Well, and also, where's Daenerys and why are they not at Dragonstone?
Right. There's why don't they go to Dragonstone, which is on an island, and whites can't swim. Why don't they go to Storm's End, which has the highest walls? Why don't they go to River Run, which is surrounded by rivers?
Why don't they just get the fuck off the continent and go to Essos and then like just... dive bomb it from afar.
Yeah, why don't they go to Dorne, where there are actual warriors? We're not allowed to go to Dorne on the show anymore. Sorry.
Never. Dorne does not exist. It fell off.
Never again.
Yep, fell off the map.
But I think, to me, that's the one thing this represents is like, oh, if that's where this ends up, that's I don't know. It's kind of dumb. Or here's the better one. Somebody actually put this in one of their emails. Again, totally forgetting who you are. Apologies. We'll be redeemed in the next life. But somebody did say something about, this actually has something to do with the next topic, which is that there are new set photos. Are you guys ready for this? of a King's Landing wall that has been built, and then there's a huge hole torn in it. So the question is, like, who created the hole? Do you think it's possible that John turns on Danny at some point and goes and allies himself with Cersei, and then Danny shows up at King's Landing and lights everybody on fire?
I mean, it's... There's certainly... Like
John
your
finds out that they're related. He decides they're not in love anymore. She screws something up.
The actors certainly have been teasing this idea that, like, Daenerys and Jon will be ripped apart for some reason next season, whether or not it's like incest angst or whatever. So what's possible is that Daenerys fucks off to Dragonstone by herself. Like, where's Daenerys? Like, I don't know, they broke up, and so she went back to Dragonstone. Oh, that'd be lame.
Yeah, or
don't let me write Game of Thrones.
Or they disagree on what the next move is as they're coming back south, and she's like, no, we need to take King's Landing away from Cersei, and he's like, no, we need Cersei's help. And his strategic brain gets ahead of his below the belt brain, and it just ruins it.
Yeah.
It's definitely a theory. That's all I'm saying. Otherwise, we have to assume that this giant hole in King's Landing is created by zombies, right?
Yeah, like a Helm's Deep sort of breaching of the wall situation.
Yeah. Yeah, because the pictures, and we found this, Watchers on the Wall has some of the pictures up, that it... It just looks, it looks like the same gate where, you know, the scene last year where Jaime and Bronn are standing there and they're looking out at the Unsullied, those really high walls. It just looks like that, but like there's a giant chunk missing. So.
Yeah.
Cool.
It looks like, I mean, you can envision like the zombies pouring through the way they did pour through the wall the end of last year. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And that being the last shot of season 8. As we await season 9, which was the real spoiler all along.
I mean, the spoilers we have are like, castles are going to fall, possibly John possibly John bends the knee, or it's a ruse.
Yeah, it's all destruction related, and then like a couple photos of John, of Kit Harington kneeling in front of Lena Headey.
I mean, it's... I'm really wary of them potentially fooling us. So
that does feel like the kind of thing they could very easily...
They didn't have to be filming that for that to be like, right. You know, there's like a guy holding a camera behind them, but like, it's just super weirdly positioned. I don't know.
Right. And they could have just picked that window because they knew photographers were out there. Yeah. I'm in on that theory too.
Every time a paparazzi, like a set photo, quote unquote, leaks from a Marvel movie, Disney is always like, oh yeah, we knew. Like, it's not like we don't see those drones out there. Like, they're like, we know.
You have a camera. We can see you.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
All right, we should end on this email. Who wants to read this one? Or no, we have one more big email and then one small email.
I'll read the big one. This is from Cecilia. I'm new to the podcast and fairly new to Game of Thrones. I finally succumbed to the hype after all these years and now I'm obsessed with the show, as everyone else is. My newfound obsession is how I found A Storm of Spoilers, which is by far the best Game of Thrones podcast. Thank you, Cecilia. But enough preamble and on to the point of my email. In my feverish binge of the show, Daenerys became my favorite character, and after season 7, I found the show left her in a very interesting position heading into the last season. But when I went looking for theories and speculation about her character, what I found was dull and often repetitive. I go on YouTube or Reddit, and every theory is that Dany will have Jon's baby and die, or she'll be killed by Jon so he could defeat the dead. I'm biased, but I'd like to think that this character will have a greater purpose than giving birth and spurring on the male hero to do male hero things. Game of Thrones can be sexist, but I don't think it's as cliche as all these countless Dany is Nisa theories. Most of these theories don't take into account her journey or if these endings make any sense for her character arc. Is it the Stan in me that thinks there's a way for Dany's story to subvert expectations without having her literally be dead? The show made me believe that Dany and Jon are equally important, but I never think that just looking at speculation for her character. Anyway, this is longer than it has any right to be. I don't think y'all are big Dany fans, but you're thoughtful and take a measured approach to the material. I'd appreciate your thoughts. So maybe Evelyn and Dragonstone, we've already come up with two.
Well, yeah,
two more interesting things.
In my mind, there's Daenerys winning theories that I don't think get discussed a lot. Like, so like just as much as she could be the Nissa to Jon Snow's prince who is promised, it could be the other way around, where she falls in love with Jon, she gets pregnant, and then she has to just kill him for some reason in order to finish this off. And I think I'm starting to build out this Jon betrays her in some way theory, but that would be one way in which Jon would end by being killed by Daenerys. So I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe there is something inherently, I guess, sexist about the way we're theorizing. Never thought we'd get to this point, but but the idea that we assume that if there's a prince who is promised, that if there's a hero of the story, that it's Jon, when there are a lot of people out there who kind of assume that it's Daenerys, and the show also has pointed us in that direction before, like when they translate the words Azor Ahai and Missandei translates it as not having a gender. Like the show has also put in breadcrumbs that are like, you guys think Jon Snow's the hero of this story, but Daenerys may have been the hero the whole time.
Yeah, and at least if I'm going to have to see one of these characters take a turn that makes them die, I'm ready to see Jon Snow make that sacrifice, and he's ready to make that sacrifice. I would much rather, as a fan, see Daenerys have some degree of victory. I don't know if I necessarily agree that her giving birth is about continuing the male hero line in this particular situation. But they would have to do some mythology work to establish that her wheel breaking applies to matriarchal and patriarchal parenting before I guess we would really be able to land on that as a completely pro Daenerys move, since stupid Jon Snow probably has to die for his son to live or daughter to live. But yeah, I mean, I think personally, I'd rather have Daenerys win of the people that exist on the show. I don't think that she necessarily has to be trapped in her wheel. She could break the wheel. I think Dany could break the wheel.
Oh, I want to address what Cecilia said about like us not being the biggest Daenerys fans, and I think the problem with Daenerys is she often gets trapped in really in both the book and the show, just trapped in some really boring or repetitive plots. But it's not really about me disliking Daenerys, I think. And especially this season, I thought Emilia Clarke really, really stepped it up in the performance department. So I mean,
once you've read the Meereen story in the book, like, it sucks the life out of her story.
I will agree that we've, like, complained a lot about Daenerys' plot lines. Like, that's what I will agree about. But, like, I would like Daenerys to have a great plot. And I also would get really mad if I saw her in the sort of Nisa position. That might, like, put Game of Thrones on that other list that we were talking about earlier of, like, shows that were ruined by their finales. Like, if Jon has to stab Daenerys in order to save the day, no. I'd get really, really mad and simultaneously bored by that. I think we're all hoping for Jon Snow to die. I mean, like, basically, you know, Liam Cunningham in an interview this week repeated that one word that George has used to describe the end of the story, which is bittersweet. Liam Cunningham reinforced that idea. And so I think that's why all of us are like predicting that whatever happens, Jon and Daenerys can't be together, since that's something that a lot of people seem to be rooting for.
Tormund and Brienne, there's still a chance.
Right. Yeah. I think you just said Jaime and Brienne. I agree with you. There's some way in which these lover relatives, Jon and Daenerys, will have to be separated. Whether one of them dies, both of them dies. Bittersweet is one of them dies and the other one lives, or they're separated. We've talked about these theories before, like Jon has to be on the other side of the wall for this new magic to work or something like that.
The Pirates of the Caribbean non-conclusion.
Yeah, I think I spoiled a beloved book series last time we talked about this theory, but I won't do it again. But I want to go back to this. That's all I have to say about that. I agree with you. I don't want it to be something really stupid for Daenerys. I would like it to be something great, and I hope we all want it to be something great. Can I go back to this paparazzi photo of Jon Snow bending the knee really quickly? Sorry.
Sure.
Just because I went back and looked at even more photos from the same day. Because Watchers had like a little bit more of a, Watchers on the Wall had a bit more of like a elaborate report than the original one that I read. First of all, I forgot that Weiss and Benioff were on set, which makes it just like makes me feel even more like it was staged. Like you see Weiss and Benioff like directing Lena Headey and Kit Harington where to stand.
No, see your right knee. You know, you put your right knee. Kit, look over here.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because originally people thought that meant that it was from the finale, but then wasn't there another director on set?
David Nutter is there.
Yeah, well,
and then it also
in the finale.
Yeah, and then also, as a lot of people point out, it doesn't appear to be winter in Winterfell. Like, the sky is blue, they can fix that, but there's also just, like, there's no snow or anything anywhere. So, like, for whatever that means. And then one other thing that people pointed out is that Lena Headey as Cersei is demonstrably not pregnant, which is, like, a fake spoiler we had from last season. You're in the storm. You're allowed to be here. That Cersei was going to miscarry at the end of the season. She didn't. So, like, maybe we theorize maybe next season's going to kick off with the miscarriage at any rate, or the show's going to end before she's showing. Who knows? Whatever. But, like, she appears to be not pregnant, though her hair is a wee bit longer. So those are just more thoughts of why I think this might be fake. But maybe it's not. We'll find out.
Some sort of fake news. We should create our own buzzword around that. I think it would really catch on.
Fake spoilers. Right.
Fake spoilers. Our last question is from James. Do you think any of the final Game of Thrones episodes will screen theatrically, like Doctor Who's 50th anniversary special? Does anybody feel like they have a definitive answer to this?
Yes. They made money doing it before. I definitely think they're going to screen... But the question is, will it be the premiere or will it be the finale?
I think they will, but I don't think it'll be during the season. I think it'll be like what they did with Watchers on the Wall, where they screened it after it had already aired as like a special theatrical thing.
Was it Watchers, like, or was it Battle of the Bastards?
No, it was Watchers on the Wall. Okay. I remember going to the IMAX and seeing it in IMAX.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I remember having seen it. It was not... airing like simultaneously or anything. It was just like a special theatrical presentation.
I'm just we have time. This is not gonna happen until 2019, but I am like filled with such conviction and dread that this finale is gonna be unpopular. And it's not a lack of faith in Weiss and Benioff. It's not that. I just feel like the stakes are so high and fandoms are so reactionary these days that I'm just like doubtful of that anyone could come up with like a finale that would satisfy people. And so I feel like they're going to lose a lot of their steam, after that finale. That's a doom and gloom prediction, but like I feel like they might lose their steam after the finale, and so then if they were to like show that finale in the theater later, it would be less lucrative than if they were to show it, you know, during the
season. That's true. It would make more sense for them to do it the premiere.
Yeah,
like here's what would really make sense is you debut the premiere at like South by Southwest.
Oh shit.
And then put it in theaters like a couple days later.
Oh shit.
No, that makes... I mean, that's a really cool way to release something. That makes zero monetary sense to me.
Plus, from a spoilers point of view, they're not going to put it up at South By and then...
That's true.
Put it up later.
Or if they premiere it, like do a cast premiere at South By and release it that same day, like on Friday. Like it all happens all at once.
It's all happening.
But that's... Or on Sunday, whatever day Game of Thrones airs. I don't remember.
I think you could make money doing this after the finale as a binge event if you put the whole season up.
Ooh, like one of those like watch all the Star Wars marathons,
yeah,
or something like that?
Well, this is basically like a whole bunch of mini movies and how they've been talking about it, the production level that it's at. There are worse things that I could binge than the final season of Game of Thrones, even if the story is bullshit at this point.
Interesting.
Worst things I could binge,
I guess,
is the name of our follow-up podcast.
The real answer
podcast
to this question is, we hope so. It's not...
Yeah, I think it'd be fun.
Yeah, I think it's possible because they've done it before and it worked. But it'd be interesting to see if they do it differently this time.
I think the only reason thing that would be stopping them is security around what's actually in it. And if they think that this is their last-ditch effort to drive people directly to HBO.
Well,
I don't... Go ahead.
I was talking to someone who knows a lot more about TV than I do, and they were saying that they thought it was a huge mistake for Game of Thrones to wait until 2019 to do this season, and that they're not going to be able to recapture their audience.
That's possible.
It feels hard to believe, but at the same time, I think that it's so hard for me to know where we'll even be in 2019. Do you know? I don't want to end this podcast on a bummer, but with everything that's happening in the world, it's just it's hard to envision a 2019 and where we'll be and what we'll be caring about, you know? So
I will say this.
I think if Marvel could make 20 movies that lead up pretty nicely to where we are, that I can at least expect Game of Thrones to keep its shit together.
However they choose to release it, I am a firm believer that it will be the most marketed thing of all time. The premiere of the final season of Game of Thrones is going to go down in history as the most marketed event of our lifetime.
Which is so funny because despite what I just said, they probably could do no promotion.
Right.
And still get it. But Neil, remember that time we watched a block of ice melt for several hours in your house?
Yeah. They know that they can do that shit. So it's just going to be months of that.
That was the most obnoxious day of my life, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Oh, no. It's going to be terrible. Yeah. But we're going to live through it
block
together.
Block of ice gate.
And
what a positive note.
Well, I was going to say until 2019, we'll still be here chatting about, thank you guys so much for your feedback about the off-season tour. Everyone seems to really like it, which just makes me really happy that we decided to keep this quote unquote Game of Thrones podcast going for the 2 years until the next season. So,
well, it's I always wanted to have real friends and we made them.
Oh, real friends.
Real friends.
Oh, man. This
Speaking of friends, Neil, what do we have to do to be up for next week's book club?
We don't have to do any book stuff, luckily.
Yet.
All right.
Though if you guys want to get started now, if you were to read A Wrinkle in Time, it wouldn't be a bad idea.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Did you catch my hint on the cold open last week? I tried to give our listeners a little head start.
Oh, okay, good.
Nice. But we are going to do another episode. We've done several episodes that are sort of focused on an individual filmmaker. We did a Stephen King episode, which is more than filmmaker, obviously. But we did a Rian Johnson episode before The Last Jedi, and we are going to do an episode about Duncan Jones, a.k.a. Zoe Bowie, a.k.a. our best friend on Twitter. He's not really our best friend, but he's cool. He's a good follow on Twitter. But Duncan Jones, the director who has now brought us Moon, Source Code, Warcraft, and as of this coming Friday, the long gestating, highly anticipated Netflix original Mute with Paul Rudd and Alexander Skarsgård.
What?
Did I get that right? I was doing that all off the cuff. Is Paul Rudd in that movie? Good.
Yeah, he is.
That's fantastic. I will say this about Duncan Jones. I love his movies. I have not seen Warcraft, but I will by next week. I have pulled the patches sort of unintentionally with Mute. I know what Mute is, sort of, but I have not actually watched any trailers. I was only kind of sure that Paul Rudd was in it until I just said that earlier. So I can't wait to watch it on Friday and discover a whole new thing that I've been anticipating for years, but still don't know anything about. This got weird.
Yeah. I'm on the 4 of a 1 to 10 level of spoiling for Mute. And I kind of wish I was back where you were.
Nice. Just, see?
So it's going to be interesting to see. Maybe
just got
to
make it a couple more days.
Yeah. Maybe I'll have a different execution based opinion next week, but we'll have to find out next week. Where I'm gonna try to get in Warcraft. I missed Warcraft, but I like Warcraft, so why wouldn't I like a Warcraft movie?
But not everyone has to watch Warcraft. I feel like that's important to note. You don't have
to
watch Warcraft to talk about this.
Mute at some point was supposed to be a semi-sequel or a sequel to Moon, so if you do have to watch one, I'd say watch Moon and Mute.
It's allegedly in-universe. We'll see.
Okay.
In universe. We'll see what that means.
Well, we don't know.
Maybe they'll just drink some slushes.
So.
Yeah, that's a good point. Is it also the Cloverfield universe?
Oh, my God.
That would be probably horrible, but at least we'd have something to talk about on next week's Storm of Spoilers. Until then, guys, where can people find more of your work online? Let's start with Miss Joanna Robinson.
Oh, hey, you can find me on vanityfair.com, or you can hear me on the podcast Little Gold Men, where we talk about award season. I watched all of the nominated shorts, so I'm going to help you nail your Oscar ballot this year on this week's episode of Little Gold Men. Or you can find me on Twitter, tweeting about figure skating and the cutting edge at Joe Wrote This.
Fantastic. I have a pre-Little Gold Men question for you.
Okay.
Negative space or garden party?
It's so funny. Between the two? Negative space, I guess.
All right. To figure out what that means, listen to Little Gold Men. Neil, where can people find more of your work online?
Get me over at the old filmschoolrejects.com. I might write something this week. I don't know. I am going to go see Annihilation and write something about it. You can get me on Twitter at Rejects. Don't forget to follow this fine program on all of your social medias, at Storm of Spoilers on Twitter. Just search Storm of Spoilers on the Facebooks, and email us stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. I will pin any writing work I'm doing up there besides my usual morning thoughts that are very surly. until next week, guys, don't fall down.
Poor little devil doesn't feel well. They made a heaven out of his hell.
Mr. Devil, I mean, look at it this way, You've got a rapid transit that crosses the river Styx. Isn't that heaven?
Isn't that?
Please, sir, watch your language.
No more those fiery furnaces I used to love to fix.
Isn't it heaven?
I think it's...
Please, sir, watch your language.
I'm feeling like the devil, just why did we have to meet?
Your heat is flameless.
I like my kingdom better before you performed your tricks. Then it was heaven.
No, then it was hell.
What?
Hell.
What?
Hell.
Watch your language.